This is LI in the AM with Jay Oliver. News, traffic, weather, and more. 1039 LI News Radio.
Well, North Korea heading to the Olympics. It's all part of a spotlight segment, first of three this morning on Long Island. Dr. David Birdsell, Mark Steen of the Austin W. Marks School of Public and International Affairs over at Baruch College. And we say a very happy new year to the fine doctor. David, how are you, sir?
I'm well, thanks, Jay. Happy new year to you, too.
I appreciate that. And it looks like we will have another participant as far as the Winter Olympics are concerned. I'm just wondering what the specialty is of the North Korean delegation. Is it going to be the ski jump, ice dancing? Is it going to be another version of the Jamaican bobsled team? David Birdsell, what do you think?
Well, it remains to be seen. Clearly, North Korea is a country that's accustomed to very deep winters. How they've exploited that for sport remains anyone's guess. They've been regular participants in the Summer Olympics since the early 70s. With two exceptions that they boycotted, one the last time South Korea hosted. But they haven't been to the Winter Olympics very often. So whether they'll be in pairs figure skating or ice dancing or something else, that all remains to be seen and remains to be negotiated with the hosts.
You know, I find it fascinating, in essence, the first breakthrough to come out of the high-level talks, first, by the way, in 2 years, taking place between the North and the South, North sending more than just athletes to the games on February 8th in Pyeongchang. The regime also will be sending a cheering squad, also an art troop, I understand, a visitors group, taekwondo demonstration team, press corps, you name it, they'll have it. And the two countries also discussing family reunifications, also having military talks to prevent accidental conflicts. With all this said, you know, I have to question, as everyone I'm thinking is doing that as well, the sincerity here of Kim Jong-un, David Birdsell, and that's really what it's all about.
Well, you have to assume right now that Kim Jong-un is very much aware of the pariah status of North Korea in the eyes of most nations and most people in the world. He's desperate for some public relations wins, show a softer side of North Korea. And this gives him an opportunity to do that in the immediately adjacent country that, of course, he believes should not exist. So this is all upside for North Korea in terms of the global optics, and he's going to try to exploit that as much as he possibly can during the window leading up to and during the Olympics.
And, of course, President Donald Trump is pretty much taking the accolades over this as far as maybe having a big role in getting these talks together. I find that somewhat hard to believe. Nonetheless, I do feel that South Korea's allegiance and alliance with the United States has prompted Kim Jong-un to maybe do some sort of, you know, listen, call it a psychological type of deal of some sort here, but nonetheless, South Korea took the bait.
Absolutely. And it doesn't stand the smell test that this was a U.S. brokered detente. This is plainly bilateral between North and South Korea. And it speaks to some longstanding needs in both countries. Of course, families were torn apart in the aftermath of the war in the 50s. Since 1953, many of those family members haven't seen one another. That's one of the reasons for the conversations right now about the reunions among what are, of course, increasingly elderly and increasingly few North Koreans who were alive during, or South Koreans, or anyone for that matter, alive during the conflict, who have the opportunity to reunite with relatives. And it drives a wedge between South Korea and the United States because it is bilateral and it is in many respects opposed to the U.S. interests, particularly this administration's interest in holding a rigid ban on commerce, on all kinds of trade, keep the blockade up and keep pressure, economic, cultural, everything, on the North to capitulate in terms of its nuclear ambitions. Donald Trump may be celebrating this, but it can't be seen in any rational universe as consistent with his overall policy regime.
No question about it. And, you know, listen, South Korea wants these games to go off in the absolute 10th degree here of being everything just right. I mean, can you imagine with North Korea not present, if they happen to put a missile test in place during these games, that could create quite a scene there?
Well, absolutely. And we have to remember that in 1988, the last time that South Korea hosted, North Korea actually blew up a KAL airliner and claimed credit for it. In a very deliberate effort to try to sow discord around the games and to make it less likely that people would attend, a very deliberate effort to make the games fail. Of course, that effort itself failed. But yes, the North has immense capacity for mischief. I think their participation doesn't undo that capacity, but it dramatically reduces the chance that something horrible will happen, of course, with North Korea an active participant in that program.
No question. Talking with Dr. David Birdsell, of course, out of Baruch College. Let's move to the TPS ending. As far as El Salvadorian immigrants, September 2019, David, this has set off a firestorm of conversation, especially here on the island, as many people now are wondering as far as their futures are concerned. Your assessment as far as the TPS expiring?
Well, this is something that the administration can do unilaterally. It was administrative relief provided for a nation at the time suffering from earthquake as well as attendant economic and social dislocations. And it's been extended for a variety of reasons, no longer related to earthquake directly, but for those same economic and social dislocations, the tremendous violence in El Salvador, and the difficulty of jump-starting economic developments, in part because of the violence and in part because of where the economy begins in the first place. So you have 200,000 people who have temporary protected status, and they themselves have almost 200,000 children who are U.S. citizens born in this country. They have a much higher workforce participation rate than the U.S. population as a whole, about 80% as opposed to about 63%. And they are productive in by almost any dimension that you care to measure. Are these really people that we want to be turning away? The Department of Homeland Security argues yes, because the original reason for the TPS status has, is no longer valid. That is, the earthquake took place 17 years ago now. There hasn't been another earthquake of that scale, and they've been able to restore infrastructure. But that infrastructure hasn't begotten the kind of economic capacity. We have to remember, too, if we switch the lens and look from the El Salvadoran perspective, that U.S. remittances, that is money that is earned by the people operating under temporary protected status here and sent back to El Salvador, is a very substantial portion of the Salvadoran economy, $5.4 billion in this last year.
Interesting as it was, you know, the Secretary of Homeland Security and Kirstjen Nielsen deciding this termination actually was required, given that the original disaster, talking about the earthquake that occurred there, that precipitated the status, had been resolved enough to terminate the protections. So there was a lot of back and forth here regarding this type of decision. But certainly logistics played a very key part here as far as the curtailing of the use of the TPS.
Well, plainly, a number of her predecessors have decided that there was no requirement that the program be rescinded. And in fact, they extended the program and provided explicit rationale both for why they were doing it and why they had the authority to do that. She's going back to the original order itself. Obviously, it is her right to make that interpretation. But it does fly in the face of the interpretations of all of her predecessors combined, starting with literally the very first Homeland Security Secretary, Tom Ridge. So this is more, I think, a matter of politics and consistency in the Trump administration. And there is one place where we can find it, and that has been an immigration policy. And the simple word is less. Return people who are here on temporary status. Haitian TPS recipients were told that they had to go home last month with another 18-month timeline that's attached to that. The whole question about Dreamers, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA program, and right now the expiration of that program set for March unless Congress acts, and reduced numbers of legal immigrants coming in through the front door in future years. So this is a consistent aspect of Trump administration policy. It is, in my view, in any case, consistent with what he promised on the campaign trail. The question is, going forward for the 2018 elections and for the next presidential election beyond, when Americans see this, is this really the policy that people wanted to see enacted? And we can talk later about what interdiction methods might involve, including very much the famous wall along the southern border.
Do we have any reason to believe that a budget deal will not be reached? I believe the date is January the 19th. That's when you could have another scare of a government shutdown. And we got high-risk stakes going here for both parties, as well as a lot of reverberations come November elections. Obviously, the tax bill at the end of the year, lots going on to start the year. Are we in a perilous situation the next couple of weeks for sure here?
Well, we are. And there are red lines for, I wouldn't just say both parties. We have at least three centers of interest here, Democrats in the Congress, Republicans in the Congress, and the president. And they all have slightly different agendas, even if they, the Republicans in the Congress, president, overlap to a greater degree than, of course, the Democrats. But you've got the wall on the one hand, which the president insists on as a condition of doing any DACA deal and by extension of any budget deal. The Democrats are insisting on doing DACA, several other things, but certainly DACA first and foremost as a condition of doing a budget deal. The Republicans in the Congress are insisting on increased defense spending as a condition of doing a budget deal. So you've got a number of cards in play with all of the parties arguing that they are inviolable and must be honored, and some of the parties, such as Democrats in Congress, saying there will be no wall, and Republicans in Congress saying there will be a military increase, but no countervailing increase in social program spending. A lot of this is political posturing as people try to walk this down the final final stretch. But there are real bones of contention here that could derail a budget agreement before the 19th.
Especially as you talked about the wall, about $18 billion or so being part of the budget. As the president has stated, the wall is going to happen or they're not going to have the DACA program set up here. And it's interesting because, you know, listen, the wall, a big part of the deal. Why? Because Trump campaigned on it. So, in essence, David Birdsell, he will have egg on his face here if it is not approved. Remember, the American people support DACA relief. I think it's a margin of 83% or so. So it's a very interesting meeting today between the president and lawmakers at the White House, especially on immigration, as well as other matters here.
Oh, that's absolutely true. And DACA is a tremendously popular program. The wall is tremendously unpopular. And I think we have to think about the wall in at least two respects. I mean, many people thought that the wall was more a metaphor, that we're going to tighten border security. Yes, there would be portions of the border that are secured by a literal wall. But what the president clearly wants to do, and there was a spending document internal to DHS released earlier this week that showed that not only is he serious about the wall, he is willing to take down the other metaphoric walls, if you will, investment in radar, investment in heat-seeking technology, investment in border security personnel, to reduce spending in order to build the physical wall. So the wall is an inarguable symbol of Trump policy. It is solid. It is obdurate. It is a physical presence. There is no subtlety to it. A number of border security experts argue that it is not an effective way to secure the border, that the ways that we have been investing in these relatively more technologically advanced approaches make more sense than the literally ancient approach of building a wall around what you want to protect. There are ways to get over walls. But the president wants to build that wall. It was one of his signature campaign promises. It's an easy visual image to keep in mind and something that he feels that he has to deliver on in order to show his power as the leader of this country.
You know, I just think that there's going to be the biggest tug of war that we have ever seen here. I mean, you talk about a quagmire. I mean, think about it, David Burrisell. Congress has yet to reach a deal, I believe, to extend the children's health insurance policy for families with no coverage. And usually, you know, that has bipartisan support. And what about this massive Senate disaster package, you know, for the hurricane hit Florida, Texas, and Puerto Rico, and then throwing California and the fire-scorched state that it has become. And, boy, you talk about a funding fight, something we have never seen before here coming up.
Well, there are certainly new challenges, and the rising level of disaster spending, obviously all the hurricanes of this season, the wildfires that you mentioned, and the promise that there's more to come. Many people believe that all of these are the result, directly or indirectly, of climate change as sea levels, as seas, oceans warm, as the rains in California become less and less frequent, wildfires more and more probable, that you're going to see more of these sort of multi-hundred-billion-dollar relief and restoration efforts required each year. That's significant new domestic spending, significant new demands for resilience activity, building any number of things from seawalls to raising the heights of buildings, changing zoning regulations for new construction, et cetera, et cetera. And all of these need to be dealt with. Of course, some of those are not well matched with the ruling party's ideology in terms of what it is that climate change means and whether it's real and whether we actually need to account for it. But push is coming to shove here right now, retrospectively, in terms of trying to invest after disasters. Right behind that is an even larger infrastructure question of investing ahead of those disasters.
Talking with Dr. David Burrisell, a couple of minutes left out of Baruch. You know, I know previous presidents, David, have sat down for a deposition as far as civil suits are concerned, but I find this present situation to be absolutely fascinating as far as what the outcome could be here. I'm talking about lawyers for the president anticipating a request for the president to talk to special counsel Robert Mueller, and right now probably discussing just how to define the parameters of any type of interview here. I find it fascinating how this will kind of pan out with Donald Trump's legal team has been preparing for the expected request for months now. His lawyers have said they're hoping for the investigation to kind of wrap it up in quick fashion. Very unusual for a sitting president to speak directly to a special counsel or any type of independent prosecutor who might be leading an investigation, but this is not an ordinary president. We know, listen, Donald Trump has said no colluding at all ever took place here. What do you sense here the outcome of this possible interview to be?
Well, the major open question right now is what form it takes. Does this take the form of a live interview with the president actually responding to questions posed directly to him? In which case, of course, he'd be accompanied by counsel, but he has the opportunity to answer any question he wishes. Counsel has already proposed that instead of a live deposition, that they be presented with a list of written questions and that they have the opportunity to respond in writing. And that, of course, allows every single answer to be massaged by, if not written entirely, by the legal team rather than by the president. So that's going to loom large in terms of the potential explosiveness of this. If Donald Trump is, in fact, responding directly to questions from Robert Mueller, this is going to be a fascinating set of possibilities. The president obviously is often surprises people, and most notably his legal team, from what he says. And this has the opportunity, the potential at least, to be truly explosive. This is the first president in some time who hasn't been trained as a lawyer or a graduate of a business program. So he's in terra incognita. It's not really his stomping grounds, and it's going to be a very interesting case indeed to watch what this testimony might look like, if it is indeed live testimony.
And finally, we're talking with Dr. Dave Wurzel out of Baruch at 7:59. You know, Democratic Party activists, well, you could sense that they could be salivating as far as Oprah Winfrey's very impassioned speech at the Golden Globes the other night, David. And, you know, a lot of people buzzing about 2020 and everything else. Listen, probably a fantasy to have Oprah in there, but nonetheless, it will take somebody of that type of caliber to combat a Donald Trump in the next couple of years. But very interesting talk, even if it is of fantasy nature.
Well, it's a very interesting talk, and for some of us, it is a sort of cautionary fable in some respects. Let's first acknowledge all of Oprah Winfrey's enormous talents and assets, that she has tremendous name recognition, that she's distinguished herself in artistic production, in a kind of soft news, in the talk show formats that she polished and perfected in the 80s and 90s and into the early years of this century, that she's been an acclaimed actress, that she's a producer of a tremendous vision and power. She's got a lot going for her, and I'll go back to name recognition as perhaps number one and all the favorables that come on with that. But it's also the case that she's not a person who has spent her life developing policy, working with government, trying to cajole the people that you need to cajole with difficult political decisions, such as the spending discussions that we were just talking about a moment ago. And as it really come down to the point that if you've got a celebrity candidate on one side, the only effective counterweight is the celebrity candidate on the other side. Now, it could well be that Oprah Winfrey, given her unique talents, will be able to prove that she has the depth of policy understanding that would be required to make a quick study of the presidency. But we're seeing how that goes on from a different end of the political spectrum right now, that this is a very steep learning curve. And for somebody, now she manages a very large media empire and has been done so in a more hands-on way, arguably, than Donald Trump has been with his media, with his real estate empire. But there's a big difference between running a company and running the United States government and acting as a diplomat on the world stage. So it remains to be seen whether there are more traditional politicians, and I definitely do not use that word pejoratively. I'm talking about people who have dedicated their lives to making government work. Are those people available? Can they make a case that that experience actually serves the American people more than celebrity and name recognition? And that's one thing that I'm going to be looking at closely as this primary battle for 2020, still two and a half years away, but as this primary battle shapes up.
Hey, one can only dream, right? It'll be very interesting, no question. Always a pleasure to have you. We'll talk soon.
Great to be here.